This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, everyone. I'm really pleased to welcome you here today. I'm Kit Poliano, the Dean of the Division of Biological Sciences at UC San Diego. I'd like to thank all of you for taking the time out of your very busy schedules to join us for this extremely timeful and impactful conversation with Dr. Jonathan Beckwith. Today's event is part of the division's 60th anniversary Deep Look into the Future of Biology series. We've relaunched this series for the fall to include topics and speakers that reflect the urgent issues posed in the world today, such as COVID-19 and the social justice movement that are reverberating around the world. These issues are giving us a chance to look beyond science at the greater social and cultural implications of research and education, and they're highlighting the deep inequities that still exist within society. As for today, I am extremely pleased to welcome Dr. John Beckwith and that he accepted our invitation to join us today for a discussion on science, social activism, and social issues in biology. He is such an inspiring scientist and leader in this area, and I know he's impacted many of us here at UC San Diego. I know you'll really enjoy his presentation today. Before we get started, I'd like to take just a minute to thank the Office for Equity, Diversity and Inclusion for co-sponsoring today's event and for the Alumni Office, which has partnered with us for the Deep Look series. This is truly a community-wide effort, and I'm really pleased about this. So to start with, I am very pleased also to introduce our host for today's event, Division of Biological Sciences Assistant Professor Sonia Neal, who received her PhD from UCLA in 2013 after working in the laboratory of Dr. Carla Kohler. She conducted her postdoctoral studies in Professor Randy Hampton's lab right here at UC San Diego and was the recipient of the Burroughs Wellcome Postdoctoral Diversity Enrichment Award and the Ruth L. Kirshine NRSA Postdoctoral Fellowship. We were so fortunate to have Sonia join our faculty in 2018, and I congratulate her on being named the 2020 Pew Scholar earlier this year. So welcome, Sonia, and congratulations.
Thank you for that introduction, Kit. Yes, I am your host for today's event, and I am honored to introduce to you all today our distinguished guest, Dr. John Beckwith. Just very briefly, Dr. Beckwith is an American Cancer Society professor in the Department of Immunobiology and Microbiology at Harvard Medical School. And just to highlight some of his achievements, as a scientist, he's made many breakthrough discoveries in the field of microbiology. For example, he is one of the first to isolate a gene from a chromosome in bacteria. And this was a very revolutionary finding in the field. And not only was he a successful scientist, he was also the scientific community's most influential champions in social justice and civil liberties. So for example, he has been an avid supporter for the Black Panther movement. He was also the first in his field to warn the public about the dangers of genetic engineering. Dr. Beckwith has been affiliated with a number of groups. He was on the ethics committee that overlooked the Human Genome Project. He was also one of the organizers for an international organization for Science for the People. Notably, he was also a very successful teacher. Since 1983, he has established a very successful course on social issues in biology to attest to his longevity as a successful class. There's many of our faculty that actually took their class as a graduate student there. And then finally, I just want to make note that Dr. Beckwith has earned a number of prestigious awards over the years for his contributions in genetics and his discussions revolving these social impact in genetic engineering. And some of the awards includes the 1993 Genetics Society of American Medal, the 2005 ASM Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Society for Microbiology, and the 2009 Salman Waksman Award in Microbiology from the National Academy of Sciences. And so, of course, I can go all day long listing all of his achievements, and it's simply amazing. All right, so I'm excited to get started here. And so we're ready to begin Dr. Beckwith's presentation. Thank you.
When I first spoke to Sonia Neal several months ago now about coming to San Diego, she was very interested in my background in history of science and how the activism resulted in such a situation in which the social activism and the teaching of social issues in biology were definitely connected. And I started in science seriously in 1961 when I graduated in chemistry at Harvard and began taking postdoctoral positions once I'd graduated. And I actually did postdoctoral positions at several laboratories, and I could do that because I was carrying on a very similar project from lab to lab. The first of these places was where I did stay was postdoctoral work at the University of California at Berkeley, where I worked under Arthur Pardee, who was a bacterial geneticist. And one of the things I noticed there was if I went out for lunch in the day at UC Berkeley, I saw lots of people standing up and giving radical speeches to whoever would stand by. And one of them I actually got to know named, well, he was a researcher, but he was also very interested in what was happening with Cuba and had been in Cuba and where something was happening, where there was some issues related to whether the Soviet Union and Cuba would tie in with the United States. Also, in the laboratory where I took at that time, Bert Pardee's laboratory, one of the students went off and spent a year in Cuba, where she cut sugar cane as an activity that people did with who wanted to go to Cuba. At the end of the year with Arthur Pardee, he got a job to Princeton University, left Berkeley, which I was kind of sad about. But I postdoced with him because I'd been interested in the research I was doing. But I went with Pardee to Princeton, and strangely enough, there happened to be one of the people who had come from Berkeley with his speeches about Cuba, and he also happened to come to Princeton at the same time that we did. And the result of that was that we were very worried about the issues related to, again, to the United States-Russia war and Cuba. And a group of us got together and created a march in the center of Princeton, New Jersey, to protest against any possibility that there might be war and even war that could be really dangerous. Stayed after 1 year in Princeton and then moved to London and Cambridge, England, and worked with the geneticist Bill Hayes, who had worked in bacteria for a long time, and also worked later in Cambridge, England, with Sidney Brenner. And while we were in London, I saw the largest march I'd ever seen, protest march in my country or here before. And they, in the middle of the time that I was in England, there was a huge march of people who were protesting the development of atomic bombs. And after those two places, I went to another place where I really wanted to stay and did stay there for some time, was that of François Jacob, who was also a geneticist at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. And I befriended in Paris because I got to know from some friends that I used to go out to drink with and ran into a lot of Black expatriates in the United States who had left from the United States to France because they didn't stand for what was happening in the United States anymore. So in the process, I was learning a lot of the experiences that Blacks had in their situation in the United States. Another little event I had which influenced me was the student who was a co-worker with me in a project at Pasteur Institute was a member of the Communist Party, which is very much much more communism in France, certainly, than the United States at that time. At any rate, we debated quite frequently in our lab, as he would argue with me about what he didn't like about the United States. The United States fighting and war mongering in too many places. So that's the end of the being in different postdoctoral fellows. And shortly after I left the Pasteur Institute in Paris, I took a faculty membership at Harvard Medical School. And so postdocs came to an end, and I took this faculty at Harvard. So there were some very effective for me for being at Harvard that I'll mention. There were some social political issues while at Harvard. The first of these was shortly, well, a few years, 1968. Martin Luther King was assassinated in the United States. And I and others were quite anguished what had happened. And we learned, as we looked into this, was what did Harvard do with black students? And we found that when we looked at the frequency of black medical students in Harvard Medical School, there were only one black student every 2 years out of a much larger medical school. And that was to at least a few of us were quite unhappy at what happened. We protested to the dean of the medical school about the poor level of taking minority students into the medical school. And we talked with the dean a bit, and we talked with other faculty trying to get people. And as a small group, we eventually presented this before the entire Harvard Medical School faculty. And a lot of the faculty were very reactionary and didn't want to have anything to do with improving the number of blacks, but some did, and it turned out that the dean was more progressive than I had realized, and after our proposal, they did have a very large increase in the number of black students in the medical school. Just the very next year, also at Harvard Medical School, we discovered something, partly because students at Harvard College and at the medical school were protesting about a lot of different issues. And one of these that came up was that Harvard Medical School owned a lot of housing near Harvard Medical School and decided that they really wanted to tear that down and kick people out who were mainly poor and minority inhabitants so the medical school could put in more houses for faculty at the time. And having worked with other students on some of these issues, I and others had helped prevent this breaking up of a community, which resulted in Harvard agreeing to build new housing and not take their house away. And again, the dean presented reasonably, so we were fortunately, but it was a struggle each time. We even had to take the dean of the school to visit what was happening to the housing, which was getting messed up, in order to try to kick people out. Then, again, a few years later, something came up which didn't have to do with Harvard's problems. But in 1970, on the same day, I received a $1,000 prize for microbiology research from the Eli Lilly Company, which was tied in with the American Society for Microbiology. And that's how I got the award. And that very day, or the day after, I read in the New York Times that Curtis Powell, one of my expatriate friends from Paris, one of the black Americans, had been in New York, arrested and imprisoned. So at the end of my speech at the Eli Lilly Award, I decided to criticize the high costs of Eli Lilly and of other pharmaceuticals companies. And also announced that I would give $500 to Curtis Powell, who was in jail at the time, and $500 to the Black Panther Health and Nutrition Programs in Roxbury. about 21 Black Panthers were eventually released shortly after. It's not with any part of my doing. So I've talked about some instances when there was a lot happening, a lot of science, and a lot, I guess we call activism. But the country all along was changing a lot in the United States, responding to issues like the Vietnam War, women's issues, and a lot of other things that people in general, and certainly some scientists were getting involved. And this all started with an organization called Science for the People, which was a group of scientists who initialed it were originally physicists who had worked on the atomic bombs, which sort of lasted with physicists, and that made them very aware of things about weapons and war and the problems arising from it. And this this organization, Science for the People, brought in a lot of different scientists into very much different groups, physicists and biologists and people who were in computer research, even so a whole range of issues. And while I was working in my lab at Harvard Medical School, I discovered after a while that two of my students were in the organization. I hadn't even known it, hadn't known of those students writing in the Science of the People organization. And after that, I got very involved myself. In particular, my genetics background it affected me at that long time and all these other issues. As the role of the scientists in the United States was an interesting time that I had just learned from some people who were in the organization. And I came upon a article in Science magazine at the time, and it was a research letter which talked about the eugenics movement in the United States, which I had not really known about that time. So what I began to have issues or thinkings about instances when social harm can persist and can hurt people. And I'm starting now in talking about this, that the historical role of geneticists in the eugenics movement in the United States is a very interesting history. And most leading geneticists were open about their belief in eugenics at that time. And most universities in biology and eugenics also taught eugenics courses in that time. And many of you may know of the details of the eugenics movement, to just go through it. The impact of the U.S. eugenics movement based on genetics arguments included a lot. First of all, many laws were passed in states in the United States which demanded and arranged at sterilization laws and miscegenation laws in states. Indiana was one of the first that really started using these laws, sterilizing people so they could no longer have children, and miscegenation laws which didn't allow people in different ethnic groups to marry. The support of the 1924 Immigration Act, in which reducing immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe was pushing, and the eugenicists, who were pretty racist and contemptuous of a lot of the other ethnic groups that were coming into the United States. And the United States passed the 1924 Immigration Act that resulted in that preventing people from certain groups being open to coming in the country. Some of those things, if you look back on time, there are some connections with some of the things we see in those days. What isn't known that much, but in the 1930s, Nazi Germany based its eugenics policies on laws and science produced in the United States. And for a long time, scientists hadn't known it, but if you've done history from the old days, you'd find that some geneticists got some prizes for their work in eugenics to be proudly brought to Germany, which was looking for as much as they could from the United States in helping them doing the extreme eugenics work they did. And these two books that are relatively recent, I think both of them had some of the information on that, but there's lots of it to find. So one of the questions as I ask as we go along is, what was the scientist's response, which I briefly already entered to some extent? First of all, I want to say that the beginning of genetics in the world, in the United States too, started in 1900. So people who were good researchers in many ways, but also went off into the eugenics area. Thomas Hunt Morgan was not particularly interested in eugenics. He was famous for starting the genetics research of fruit flies, one of the great groups of types of organisms that were studied in genetics in those days. But one found in the literature. One was a letter from Thomas Hunt Morgan to someone else. Morgan said, if they eugenicists want to do this sort of thing, well and good, but I think it is just as well for some of us to stay with a better standard and not appear as participators in the case, the eugenics. And after that, he said, I have no desire to make any fuss. It's something that is one of this has occurred that bothered me. He eventually did write some articles criticizing eugenicists and published some critical articles in academic journals. It was not the kind of thing that people would get much information from it. But his having no desire to make any fuss really bothered me. And it's something I've heard of in other instances in science where, we don't like that, but we don't have anything to do with it. And my most shocking thing happened to go back to Harvard Medical School when I was a faculty member there. Found that there was a chairman of our department who taught some genetics courses in a medical student class. But he not only did that, he was told us that he was going to introduce more genetics in my class. So I and another one went to this faculty member's plan to talk, and I was stunned, really. This is now 1970. In 1970, he gave this talk, and it was a eugenics talk, including talking about minority groups in the area around a Harvard medical student, saying that you could watch them, the children were obviously defective. You could tell just look at them in the area. So over the years, many of the kinds of issues that I dealt with had to do with genes and human populations and human behaviors. And something that's come up as a very popular issues at some times and found very critical certain times also. In 1965, the researcher Patricia Jacobs of Edinburgh and from the United States was interested in looking at the question of whether men who had an extra Y male and were therefore XYY male might be showing up as criminals in society in general. So she and her group went to in Edinburgh to a institute for the criminal people who were supposed to be at least. And they went through the genetics. They looked at the chromosomes of the entire population of this place in Edinburgh. And from that, Jacobs and co-workers published a worker which was published in Nature and was called Aggressive Behavior, Mental Subnormality in the XYY Male. And that jumped quickly, very popularly, in various ways, and to various people. These are examples of three magazines I sort of found at the time, Chromosomes and Crime in Science Digest, Of Chromosomes and Crime, Time Magazine, Born Bad, Newsweek Magazine. But something made it become a bigger thing, at least in the United States. And this happened because of a person named Richard Speck. And it took place in 1966, And what this guy, Specht, did something actually quite horrible. He discovered that there were a group of nurses who had housing where 89 women lived who were nurses and would work in the hospitals. But Speck one night got into this housing area that the nurses stayed, and he killed all 8 or 9 of them at the time. Well, why Richard Speck and XYY? Well, it first came from a situation in which a scientist, not a well-known scientist, but somebody sent in a letter to the in Chicago newspaper saying that this Richard Speck was very tall, he had acne, and he behaves as a murderer. And those were characteristics which they thought really held to the situation for XYYs. Her name was Mary Telfer. I really don't know her background. But the curious thing was that a researcher at Vanderbilt University decided to take a second look as whether Richard Speck was an XYY male. And he knew how to look at those differences. And he did several collections many times the blood to be absolutely sure, and found there were no XYY males in that man, Richard Speck, of this journal. Didn't seem to really, Vanderbilt University School of Medicine really didn't reach people. You didn't see anywhere where there was things until researchers started to begin to really research more seriously. But as I said, the finding that these men were not XYY male was pretty much ignored. In the following up science, there's been lots of things that were done that were not very clear, but that showed that there were things wrong with the studies that had been done, but not taken very seriously because it was seemed like such a importance to people and to scientists together, I guess. Other scientists did work in this, and another example was when a group went disproportionately found into prisons, and they never found any X or Y males. That doesn't disprove it, but the numbers were good that made it sound, didn't sound right. But enough studies were done, and actually studies in families where there were X, Y, Y males, that many scientists criticized the conclusions of the papers, the old one, and their 1974 review stated, the frequency of antisocial behavior of the XYY male is probably not very different from that of non-XYY persons. There were other issues that came up from the studies that did follow. XYY males were not aggressive generally, even the ones found in prison. If you selected them, ones who are aggressive and really aggressive, which had been ignored but was picked up, they were not proportionately found in prisons. We wrote a letter about some of these studies, some friends of mine, because we were criticized of the XYY story, and included a scientific review of the things that I've presented here. So by 1975, there was enough evidence from further studies to demolish the myth of the coronal chromosome. But persistence of this myth became a cultural truth in various parts of our culture. The first thing that happened that was a bit of a backwash on the part of Patricia Jacobs. So in 1965, she had published this article about the criminal gene, the XYY males. She, in 1982, which is 15 years later, gave a speech at the American Journal of Human Genetics, where she actually won a prize that year, in which she, in her speech, said, "In retrospect, I should not have used the words aggressive behavior in the title of my paper and should not have described the institution as a place for the treatment of individuals with dangerous, violent, or criminal propensities." So she did finally, after some time, show some remorse for it, but it didn't impact anyone. It wasn't suddenly released. So it was still something that people believed in. And this gives you an example. Going back to 1993, I bring in first my son, who was in school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and his modern biology book had a picture of Speck in it as an example of an XYY male. In England, there was a writer who came up with a book where he chose a lead person for the MI5, who would be a very strong critical person who could do all sorts of critical things, critical issues. And he chose the idea of the XYY man as being the MI5 of the United of England, as was also presented in a series of films on TV that again had him presented as the XYY male. Another movie that was XYY male, a villain, was the Italian horror movie maker. I've forgotten his name at the moment, but very violent maker of his violent stories. It was an Italian movie, and he was presumed, because they had made him an XYY in those movies. The most striking, to me in a way, is what happened to Sigourney Weaver. Sigourney Weaver was in a spaceship that she was flying away in the Aliens movies, and she had an accident in which Sigourney Weaver and her spy ship crashed into a planet. When she found this planet, was only had in it males. There were no females at all, and she found out what the story was. And the men who were there, and the leader of them, spoke to Sigourney Weaver and said, the YY chromos are thieves, murderers, rapists, and child molesters and scum. And the reason was that these men had been sent from our planet to this one that Sigourney Weaver had fallen on by the United States government, that didn't want all those XYYs in themselves. Television stories, too, of course. In 1993, there was one example I'll start with as an example called Born Bad in Law and Order in the United States, where a lawyer of a 14-year-old boy claims he's not responsible for the beating death of his friend because he had an extra Y chromosome and is genetically predisposed to criminal behavior. So the social consequences continued. Not quite that long ago, but it was a fairly time again. There were places where, and one of them was in Baltimore, Maryland, where Johns Hopkins Medical School is, and a project was set up to screen juveniles for XYY males in the population of Baltimore, and overwhelmingly they took the black population to screen. And many fewer white people. And what's important about that, interesting, that this maybe kind of little thing, that thousands of black kids in Baltimore were screened, as I said, and that resulted in lasting mistrust from people who lived in Baltimore. I'm not in Baltimore, but they wouldn't work or go to Johns Hopkins Medical School at all. And that's well known, that they were really put off from Johns Hopkins because of that, that what had been done with the kids who were not XYY males but were black. All other things that were consequences of the original XYY story were people, parents, being led to or think they should have amniocentesis and abort XYY males. Something else, if you think about it, one can also worry about stigmatization of XYY children and their parents, where parents were affected by thinking that their child was going to grow up a criminal, and the children themselves thought we're going to be XYYs. Research screening of baby boys for XYY was done in some approaches, some cases, and I'll come to them in a second. But one of the other impacts of this XYY story, I should go back a bit. I've taught this class, Social Issues in Biology, for many decades. And when I asked, presented the information of the XYY story to students, I would ask them, have any of them heard of the XYY male? And I found that they were quite familiar with it, and most of them didn't realize that it had been in large part abolished as a real issue in the XYY story, but people still remained it some way or another. And it came really close to me by the fact that we discovered through a friend of mine who worked at one of the Harvard hospitals, the Children's Hospital, someone who is in that same department, was concerned about screening for XYY males. So we looked into this and realized that the studier of the Jinx was going to another local hospital, Women's Hospital, at Harvard Medical School. And the researcher was going into the women's hospital, and for those women who were pregnant and coming into situations where they'd be tested to see whether they had XYY males. And there's it was a terrible study in lots of ways. It was based on the poor science that had already been shown. And we actually connected with people who misled by parents who thought their children were going to be XYY. And this stimulated us in looking into it and raise issues. We went to a university committee at Harvard Medical School, where they have a committee to deal with problematic issues, and filed a complaint with a university committee. And I mentioned already that we'd written the article in the New Scientist on the subject. And many of the committees thought that the studies should be stopped. The people were in this committee that were looking into it, but they told me that that a majority had voted majority against it, but the chair of the committee, who was one of the old-timers there, went ahead and gave the study the go-ahead that they could continue with the study. We were very disturbed that that happened and nothing was done about it, and that it was misrepresented by some of the people who'd seen the people. So we were concerned enough that we took the complaint to the Children's Defense Fund in Boston. They, in turn, the Children's Defense Fund, was very concerned about it and went to brought the case to the state attorney general in Massachusetts. And the state attorney general visited the researcher who was doing the screening and stopped and said, told him that they should not be screening at all. Shortly afterwards, because this got a lot of publicity, we read that in some countries and where screening was going, because it was happening in many other places for XYY, and several at least that we knew of were situations in which they stopped the screening. Afterwards, a faculty who didn't like what we had been doing at all said that they went up to us and told us that if we won't drop this, and that we should have to leave Harvard and be punished. Nothing happened. I don't know what the idea was, but they never actually anyone punished or kicked us out or anything. So no punishment took place. So here's the good news in a way. This is 2007 now, and it's another mystery story, and it's a story where the police in Miami, in the CSI Miami, had discovered several people who'd been killed, and they found the killer, and they claimed they thought he might be an XYY male, and they were going on thinking that this is what they were going to find, but somebody, it looked like, went to an encyclopedia or something, one of the women who worked there and raced into the CSI Miami, one of the people in this group. She said, you know, it's all wrong, that XYY was wrong. And in Boston, they were bothering people and parents, and it sort of reconstructed what we had said there. And I never could find out how I'm assuming it's maybe just from the newspaper that it happened. So, but I think of this as of the cultural lifetime of the XYY male. Here we are 42 years before it really began to have some basis for forgetting it. Dr. Jacobs continued her research, and she's probably a good researcher in many ways. And in this, I followed her work afterwards. She did continue looking at males with extra Y chromosomes and other kinds. But she said males with XYY had normal range IQs, had marked difficulties in speed and language, motor skills, and educational achievement. Nevertheless, most adults will live independently. And this is just a couple of reviews I put up. Does anyone know of Nayon at UCSD? Because I met him about the XYY story a few years ago at Harvard. And he had studied the whole history with XYY, but more from the case of how parents dealt with it, but also dealing with it with agents or companies with parents who organize such situations in which a bunch of people have a particular condition, and it's traditional that there are organizations to bring in families with children with problem issues. And what Nayon showed was that the males of XYY, as I've said, had normal range IQs, but they were then actually ended up being included with part of the group of people, of parents of Spectrum Autism Organization. And it had been present for a while. And at some point, the families of extra Y males were brought into the autism organization with an incredibly change from what we saw from the beginning, the whole story in the cartoon-like books that they received and were hand-treated very well in much better ways, almost seems, than what Jacobs had. But it's kind of ironic that you're back on such happy extra Y people in this story. So these are kids who may have broad spectrum autism, and no issues are coming up that are worryful. But however, we're not back over the story of genes and criminality, because it wasn't long before that there was another one, and it started at a Science magazine article entitled "Abnormal Behavior Associated with a Point Mutation in the Structural Gene for Monoamine Oxidase A." And it was suggested that this issue of monooxidase A was people with that problem would be criminalities such as the XYY had. I mean, it wasn't mentioned that. It starts with 1993, a Dutch group reported finding a family in which males who carried a mutation that eliminated the function of a gene for monoamine oxidase A, MAOA, and had existed in instances of social behavior. And the speculation of the paper was that given the wide range of variation of MAOA activity in the normal population, one could ask whether aggressive behavior is confined to complete MAOA deficiency. But since that time, no similar family has been found of this sort. And if you look at the further studies on MAOA polymorphisms in different countries and different groups of people, different ethnic groups, whatever, led to conflicting findings. It was never found otherwise. One thing I should organize, which I think is one of the most upsetting to me, is for some years now, someone picked up early the idea that people of New Zealand, indigenous people, are Maoris, and they are said to have, I don't think it's actually as true as one says, has not been further studied on MAOA polymorphisms, was leading to all this criminality. And but then when you looked at it, the conflicting findings, if you look at all the researcher that continued this study, it kind of fell through. But for a long time, the MAOA idea was held up as something that indicates the criminal behavior of this indigenous group. I don't know what's happened with it now, but I wrote on it a couple of years ago. So this got a lot of interest in all these papers and the public, etc. Science Magazine had an article entitled "Evidence Found for a Possible Aggression." One of the examples, Newsweek brought this picture and genetics of bad behavior, a study links violence to heredity. And here the picture that they have is promoted in this is a picture that was argument or beating of Israelis and Palestinians, and somehow MAOA is responsible for the reasons for, I'm exaggerating what they said, but that would explain violence, and that's why Palestinians are so violent. This is U.S. News and World Report, which a magazine not that bad, but the cover was bad enough. I won't go on with that. There was also another Law and Order book. It was a Great Britain one, because the U.S. had already done it, but Law and Order made a remake of the former use of Law and Order, Born Bad, but named Unloved. And they explained the murder as being due to MAOA. There are others that where it was affected. Now, just to say something about the researchers again, what did they do? Dr. Brunner finally said something at a symposium in England, which is not really widely spread even, saying that the notion of an aggression gene does not make sense. So that was the head of the leader of the research group on MAOA, and he cut down on what he had said. Alexandra Brakefield quit working on the subject of research of genes and genetics. And she was dismayed at what its social consequences were, which you've seen in this presentation. But I mentioned already the MAOA gene story. So what is to be done and why, whom, by whom? One, I think this is the one example. A recent paper from 2002, Science Magazine, story, Genetic Structures of Human Populations, and I would imagine some of you must know this work. The leader of the group was Joan Lenoa Rosenberg, who is a professor at Stanford University and head of this research group. And it used the methodology by Jonathan Pritchard, and big names in this one. And I'm going to say from the start that I think it's in lots of ways very good ways, but the way it's presented had problems. So Science, as I said, Science Magazine published it in December 2002. And this was the graphic of the paper. And this is, I think, a terrible paper. What people came taking away with this paper, which is a group, seemed to be a grouping of peoples, and you'll see differently what I say afterwards. It looked like there were people who grew in totally distinct, almost races coming out of it. And you'll see what happens when you present things that way. They were trying to see about differences between groups of people, but there are no polymorphisms specific to one group. There are no race-specific genes, and extremely difficult even for scientists to figure out what the thing is about, which allowed it to be used in a terrible way. But I want to say that I knew Noah Rosenberg himself. I was at a forum on human genome, which took place at Stanford University a number of years ago. And I got to meet him. And a number of years later, we happened accidentally to bump into each other at Madison, Wisconsin, at the university. We were both visiting Madison, both staying in the hotel, again, without knowing that that was going to happen, but both quite busy. But the first thing that happened was Noah Rosenberg came up to me and said, "We were naive." In other words, he was admitting that he was naive to not do the work in such a way that he could avoid that there would be misrepresentations of the studies. And these are the kinds of things that I think really disturbed him. One was a book published by Nicholas Wade, who was, for a long time, a very good science writer, but he chose to take the work of Rosenberg and his co-workers and use that to make an argument over a whole book based on the research that blacks first, but other things too, could be chosen to be a particular specific race, defined race. Genes, race, and human history. If you note that one of the three people I know were involved in supporting Nicholas Wade's book, I think it was Jim Watson and Charles Murray, both of whom have spoken out before about race in a negative way. And E.O. Wilson also has in small places talked about genetics and race, but people have actually talked to him to stay off of it. That's not all. That's not all about this story. Stormfront organization was very happy with, this is the, you can go on that if you want to. It's the, one of these organizations that are racist and very proud of themselves. And they, as an organization, have affected a lot of the negative stuff that's going on in our country in the moment. They found Nicholas Wade's book. One of the leaders in the Stormfront organization made a review of Nicholas Wade's book, saying, again, a troublesome inheritance. And then genes, race, and human history. So I was fascinated, actually, with looking at this, the organization itself, about how much time they put to their interest to genetics research, the following a lot of genetics a lot, and that found to me a little scary. So now I just want to finish all of these, because I think that's in a way connected to issues of social issues in biology. Scientists' responses to the social impact of science. So I've brought this up in certain ways during the talk, so I think it has a much broader thing than what I ever did. I have no desire to make any fuss. Morgan said, if you've got enough of him to know what he did or didn't do. In retrospect, I should not have used the words aggression behavior in the title of my 1965 paper. And she waited till 1982 from 1965 to do anything about it. Xandra Brakefield might have, instead of quitting the work because she didn't like that kind of science, didn't speak out about it at all. And Rosenberg, I feel a little better, because he said we were naive. And since then, he's written a lot of papers that make much better clarify the research that was done about his group. So something to think about. Examples of complex and questionable science are overinterpreted by scientists sometimes. Science journals can have problems too. And the media either naively or purposefully disrupts, causes things that become very open to everyone. So the publicity of these, I'm not sure how much scientists think about this, the publicity of these kinds of things I've talked about today can influence social policy, cultural norms, and even harm people over long periods of time. Scientists, for the most part, even when regretting the outcome, do little to debunk mistaken notions publicly. This is the end of my presentation, but I'm happy to hear from questions you have about these issues.
All right. Well, thank you, John, for that fascinating talk. Just
absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh. So again, welcome Dr. John Beckwith and Kayla Davis, who is a graduate student in Harvard Med. And from my understanding, she's preparing her thesis defense, which is in a couple of weeks, but she's also an instructor in John Beckwith's social issues and biology course currently. And so she's also here to answer any of your questions today. And so I believe, John, you have a video you wanted to show the audience. So we're just going to allow the questions to trickle in as we see this video.
I think some of you read in the series of the slides of the time I spent in Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And it was one of the places that influenced me. Very short time there, but I would go to the lab every day and did a lot of work. And started going out for lunch. And my problem was that I saw people standing up on boxes and things to give talks and lectures about political issues. I think there was one person I remembered that was a scientist who had been to Cuba and was talking about all the bad political stuff that was going back and forth with Russia and the United States and Cuba. And so I started talking with the people and got to know them. And it was the first time I've been an undergraduate at Harvard for quite a few years, and I'd never seen anything like this, people with such political attitudes. And I only started getting really, as I was working on this series of slides here for the talk, how much I connected with Kalama Harris, whose parents lived there for a long time, and when Kamala was becoming very well known politically in the United States, a lot of articles wrote about her how she talked back in this. We weren't there at the same times, but she would have been younger than me. But that she had had a family that had entrenched her in ideas of social and consequences of, not of science in particular in this, but in political work, etc. So here we have here the picture of Sproul Plaza, I think the name of it is, at University of California, Berkeley. And that was the place where every day, if you wanted to go down and hear about what was right or wrong in those days, I'm kidding, but there were just a lot of people out there. And Kamala, in the stories that have been written about her and what she talked about, was how a very small girl, her parents would take her out to what was going on in the campus, this aspect of the campus, and that did affect her a lot. And I thought, my God, that's what I came up with in my mind. I hadn't thought about it in a while. And it came to my mind that we'd had something in common, both of us very much affected for it. But I think that it's, in a way, if you go back, think way back, that around Berkeley and the University of California, Berkeley, was really the start of a lot of the social activism in the United States. We knew that a lot of those activities had started back then, and that had led to a lot of the things that happened that have now run for decades, for many, many time.
All right. Thank you. Yes, Sproul Plaza was definitely really charged, influential in many ways, John. I remember about the free speech movement being initiated there. So yes, it's very interesting. And we actually have a question from the audience. So let's begin. This question is from Claire Adida. So she is a social scientist
who teaches about race as a social construct. And so her question is more pedagogical focused. And so her question is, what are some of the most compelling strategies with arguments, readings, anything, for showing students that are not biology majors that while physical differences are real, race as a genetic concept is not? It's a good question.
Well, if you go back to 2002, and I'm going to be talking about the science aspects of it, in a way, the person who wrote that book in 2002, Noah Rosenberg, et cetera, and he was very unhappy because he didn't think that, and I tried to show that in the statements that they came up about things, but he wrote several books that are really worth reading. I complained before that things don't get out to the public, but I think it's important to find. I'm actually working with a group right now, a small number of group who've been working at the recent studies that have been carried out on genetics and behavior, et cetera. And we feel that particularly in the last, let's say, 20 years or so, there's a series of papers that seem piece by piece break up the idea for clear races being something you can really substantially do without what's being done today. People using several different genetics approaches, I think, coming into it with similar crosses between the different groups, but they're doing very, very different techniques. But together, I think they make a stronger field. We're trying to put together a group of these articles. We didn't do the actual research, but we're taking them. We've read through the research. We've communicated with some of them. We're trying to put those things to give to people and take a look among scientists. It's complex. Genetics, I mean, is the problem in a way, but it's clear that if you start back to the, say, 30 years, there's a big change. And one of the problems was trying to look at more people that would give you more data, which was happening in some cases. So it's not, I can't say the methodology and approaches are simple, but I think it's worth a try. And maybe having just a group of people trying to figure together whether I could communicate to people what things we're thinking about and writing about and publishing.
Sonia, can I just add one tidbit to that? You know, one of the pieces of work that we read in class is the work of Brian Donovan, and Brian researches pedagogical methods for talking about race in biology with high school students. And so I'd really recommend looking at his work, which is ongoing, and you can go through the data, and he's looking for the best ways to do this. But one of the main things that he's taken from his work is that it's really important to start these discussions in high school biology when students are just becoming familiar with these concepts of genetic differences between populations, and just start talking about race then.
Actually, Kayla, I was wondering, because the social issues in biology has taken off in Harvard, is there any attempt to disseminate this type of course to K-12 students? Is it possible to do that pretty soon?
Yeah, so one of the current efforts at Harvard has been just to get the course kind of to move beyond the social issues in biology classroom itself. And so students and postdocs have started a journal club at Harvard, and so that is moving. I'm not aware of any efforts, and maybe John can speak. I know he's had many students who have carried on this type of work to reach out to K-12. Specifically, and as you know, we're just starting to be good about having these kind of conversations within academia. But I think that it's so important that we do move the conversation in that direction and start to bring it up earlier and earlier.
You know, some of the research that Kayla's talking about was actually from Stanford University, also some other people, but They ended up in a study group or study company that looks at education in general and has people doing studies from... He got many grants from the National Science Foundation, which kind of... So he's in the middle of these projects right now, but unfortunately, from all the holes, it's the school problem we have right now. Hopefully he got money to do such studies in a very large number of countries, large number of states in the United States, and to get people to do compare the exam in different schools. I think it's we. Not going through the entire detail, but if you want to look at it, his name is Donovan, Brian Donovan, and he works for, do you remember the name of the organization that he works with? Is called BSCS. It's a company that used to make school books, but now it's doing studying of schools, and that's how a lot of these issues have started that way.
Okay, thank you. So another question from the audience by Fandica Chapman. This is a good question. Is it naive to believe that we can ever control the way that science is taken up by the public / social forces? Do we run the risk with all research that the utilization of science may be used to control, demonize, or oppress different vulnerable populations?
Well, the environment of the United States is not an easy way to figure out how things are going to change. One never knows. One can hope if things get turned around and different. But I think we collaborated with Brian Donovan and his work, and with some of our work we were doing, which was related to the studies that Noah Rosenberg had wrote. And that was, we made had a session at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And at that we had speakers in our group, which they were very positive about, at the AAAS. And one of them was related to what we were talking about with Brian Donovan, and the other is some of the more recent genetics that goes on, but hardly gets any attention at all, would change very different, I think, the views of genetics. And it got picked up by the New York Times. I don't know if any of you saw it, interviewed Donovan and was at the AAAS meeting, where these talks were given on those studies. So I don't know if there are other people doing that kind of thing, but I think one of the things that bothers me is that people like to do their science, and they may do wonderful things in science and not care very much of whether it's so good that they should go out and actually involve people in taking that information and move it into a more public or educational or whatever session. So people don't think much. They love their work, which we all do. But if it has some uses, then it should go out there and people do something with it, if it's positive.
All right, thank you. All right, so we can ask another question. This is more about recommended approaches for teaching concepts to undergraduate students or even high school students. So for example, students can struggle to reconcile how there are not race-specific genes, as you mentioned from the 2002 Rosenberg paper, yet certain gene mutation-based diseases are more prominent in different racial or ethnic groups. For example, sickle cell in Black people. Is there a good text or resource you can recommend to supplement these discussions?
We've been doing something like that about sickle cell in particular, where it's misused as a way of indicating about what a people are and whether their genes are all the same. what we noticed was that HHMS, do you know that? That's the, I forgot, HHMS is funds a lot of programs. And they had a very nice picture on the history of the discovery of sickle cell. But we noticed in reading this, it was one of us got the view of it from the company, and it's near Washington, D.C., I think. And we found that it really misrepresented thing, but what you saw mainly was blacks from the United States. And it comes off that sickle cell anemia is just for certain people in certain regions, when there's certain other factors in society that can cause genetic disease, that cause diseases. So we contacted them and told them that they were getting a misrepresentation of the spreading of sickle cell anemia, that it occurs in places where they're more likely to get in touch with the causes sickle cell disease. And it's just the HHMI program segregates people by assumptions that they must be like all the other people who have sickle cell, and they cause one group. And I sent that in, and I knew the guy who was a major involver in HHMI, and he was very supportive to what I said, but I don't know whether they've changed it or anything. But I think there should be a lot of efforts of people doing that kind of thing. People just, go ahead. Sorry, Kayla.
I was just going to say, for the part of the question about an example of how to have some of these conversations, especially with younger students, I'm putting the title of an article, which John participated in the chat. And so that's an article with the American biology teacher. And that goes through some practice dialogues of how to have these type of conversations. And I think it just sets a really great example of different conversations that might come up and how you can reply to some of the most common things that people say.
Wow, thank you, Kayla. So we have room for several more questions for you, John. So one question from anonymous attendee: what do you say to modern day scientists who still cling to Morgan's point of view? I have no desire to make any fuss, as an example. How do you convince them, especially for those of us who are trainees trying to persuade tenured professors?
Part of the incentive for this whole program we've had and interactions with UCSD above that was the issue of what kind of training young students get. And can they find ways of investigating? And we've taught courses in various programs and go back and do some of the history and see where things can go wrong. And so I'm encouraged by the interest here at UCSD, at least for some of the people that are here. We've also been approached by several other schools. MIT wanted to do some course. Someone in another course in the Hutch in Washington. I've lost track, but there are people who are interested enough so that they hopefully will affect it enough so they'll want that happen with their professors also to teach the courses. Strangely enough, when this course still started, I started teaching the course because I wanted to do it, and partly from the incentive of Kit Poliano at Harvard, actually lit a little fire that got me giving a full course. And I was leading the course maybe for a couple of months, and the chairman of the department said, well, you can't have a course like that, studying those things. That's not science. And you're not a sociologist, and you're not this and that. But I think all of us can be anything. It's actually something I should say more strongly. I mean, a lot of the work that one does in these cases, they may be very hard to do, or maybe very difficult, and very difficult in some senses when they're actually badly done science. But people should feel, and I think a lot of people I've worked with feel that they can feel comfortable going in, at least after some part of their lives have got to the point where they really think, well, these are real issues we should know about, and they could be hard, but I think you can look at it. And we've done this, a lot of us, for over the years. And I've heard other people saying, are talking about that, who are also interested in these issues. That is, the issues of reaching people to another thing, which I think is important, is it is useful and it doesn't hurt to have, with things that I've had, where the groups of people working and doing these, looking at these issues and how to write new things about the issues, I think it's there are advantages to have people that you can, under some conditions, I think sometimes things work very well when you have a small group that comes from different areas. Sometimes people from not directly in science can have something and ask some questions that can be very useful. And a lot of the work I've been involved with many decades, involved people who came from a whole range of disciplines.
Okay, thank you. This is actually a question I want to get out because it's so timely. This question's from Ethan Beer. Given the current highly polarized political landscape now, with the disturbing trend of underlying racism resurfacing in seemingly legitimate discussion forums, how would you suggest thoughtful politicians should communicate in a clear fashion how science does not support such neo-racist arguments? It's a great question.
Just first of all, I'd say schools are very important, and I think Kayla already talked with it about schools. Go ahead, Kayla.
I was just going to comment, you know, I think it's a hard conversation to have for even us as skilled scientists, right, to try to figure out the right words to talk about, you know, genetic basis of race and to be, you know, very careful in our wording there. And so one thing that I would suggest is that, you know, I think more and more scientists are running for political office, which is great. And, you know, more and more politicians are listening to scientists and hiring them to work in their offices. And I think that that's one really fantastic way to start to get at these things is, you know, to take a little bit more of a whole view in having these conversations, to include scientists in politics more. And then also I want to encourage everyone listening, if you're interested in these kind of things, to get involved in politics, to reach out to your local representatives, because a lot of these representatives are looking for the voice of scientists, especially their constituents, and are willing to take advice from scientists. And so I would encourage everyone to get involved. I think that's one of the best ways for politicians to address these issues is not to necessarily, I mean, certainly they should educate themselves, but I think that they should lean on experts in these areas as well and figure out how people have carved out how to already do this.
Very informative. One more question. This is from Dr. Cresta Madigan. Dr. Beckwith, can you comment on how changes to medical student education might help address the healthcare disparities that impact minorities in the U.S.?
There is a group, a Black medical student group at Harvard Medical School, and they were protesting. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they started finding all sorts of problematic issues on medical treatment of people, minority people in general. And I think those issues, well, at least the issues, a lot of the issues, for instance, amongst minorities are, that you have this, that or the other issue to begin with, whatever. And this group in particular, and I actually got some of the information from the studies we carry out in our course to graduate students, that they were looking for specific issues that in which doctors at Harvard hospitals are taking misideas about some of the worst possible conditions are in one group or not another, and it's kind of constant. I think there's more publicity of it, at least within that school. It was very productive. They had a whole library of publications and had people look at them and show how things were getting distorted.
Okay, thank you. So we're just about out of time. Thank you, Dr. Beckwith, for your wonderful talk and spending time with us here today. Thank you, Kayla Davis, for participating in the Q&A sessions with such insightful ideas. And thank you to the rest of the audience for attending today's event. And we look forward to attending to future closer conversations, seminar events by Bioscience. So thank you again, everyone. Have a great day.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.